We welcome in our friend Colin Fleming. His latest book is If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. Bless you, Mr. Fleming, and hello.
Oh, hey, man, just some forewarning. I'm pretty sick.
Oh, no.
I've been pretty sick since last week, so if there's, like, some tuberculosis-like coughing fit, we can still do this. Just carry on. Just give me a second. I just made a 439 dash to the CVS. I couldn't take it anymore, so I'm slathered in the vapor rub.
Oh, well, a Zulu warrior will go that route. Now, when I was little, my grandmother would occasionally even suggest putting that in my like the roof of my mouth, which I don't think you're supposed to do.
Well, maybe she was on to something, because that spot under my tongue, that tie where it like attaches to your mouth, that's hurting me, and I'm all lungs congested, and I almost canceled on you today. Then I was thinking, you know what? I have an Iron Man streak here, and I haven't missed a segment since 2017. And you know what, Kimball? It was on this day, on May 31st, that Lou Gehrig played in his 2,000th consecutive game. And then I thought, well, I'm going to have to slather. But things are dire when I am making a desperate break for the CVS, because normally I forgo things of that nature. But, yeah, I was getting a bit concerned there.
Man, so lemon water in and of itself is not enough.
Well, I guess I should come clean. I've been sick since last week, and on Saturday, I probably didn't need to walk the 6 miles and run 3,000 stairs to test myself, and I didn't have to follow that up yesterday, rather Sunday, with 5 miles and 3,000 stairs, and I thought, this isn't helping matters, so yesterday I just walked 9 miles, and lo and behold, Kimball, I've gotten progressively worse.
Oh, dear.
This day, where, say for my CVS dash, I saw my former mentee, and she gave me this strange look. I didn't recognize her at first through my roomy eyes. So it's almost like that guy in the playoffs. It's game 7, and you're going to shoot me up in the locker room, in the knee. I might just like be good for a half, but for you, I'll be good for the full game.
So you're like the downtown version of Willis Reed.
I am, but like when you go to that game, it's kind of like a token appearance, right? He's like, I'm out here. I'm going to take some shots, and then I'm going to leave. And that's not my style, Kimball. I am draining that buzzer beater fourth quarter. That's my game.
You're putting up 42 and grabbing about a dozen boards.
You know what, Kimball? I'm healing right now. I'm feeling pumped. I'm firing myself up. Let's do this.
It's Power of Downtown. Well, we're going to talk today about more stories from your newest book. And I four stories that we'll talk about today. And I think all of them in some way deal with loss.
They deal with loss. Well, many things in life deal with loss, right? I mean, life is a series, a succession of losses and reaping meaning, I would say, within the context of those losses. It's very much like my monument, which remains closed. And the title of this other book that I've done recently, You're Up, You're Down, You're Up. So I think there's great opportunity in loss, not just for progressing in life, but for clarity. And so my characters have certain things in common, as different as they are from each other. They often have to make decisions. They're not flat by any means. They're certainly not prosaic. And I think they invite the reader in and task the reader like with that question of what would you do? What would your decisions be? My characters make a lot of decisions, and the decision isn't like, do I shoot this person or do I not shoot this person necessarily, but the graver decisions of life and loyalty and questions of that nature.
Well, in A Deuce Crossed, we deal with a family dynamic here, Fenner, Tim Fenwood, his brother Thale, and their mom, and I love the way you explain the relationship between Mom and Thale. They did a lot of talking through looks, like they were partners in some undertaking you weren't being let in on.
That's one of the things about the ways we communicate, the different forms of language. And that example you gave right there is rendered in the story, in the book, in the language of letters, of the written word. And what it is representing, though, is that language of glances, the different ways we communicate. So it's like this modulation almost, where the two different kinds of looks are working in this progression. but also in tandem. And so I think some of the ways that people falter, especially now in this age, as language skills devolve, is so much interaction of any profitability is in person. And a lot of our interactions simply are not going to be in person, save with people in our immediate family, and especially with the emphasis on technology and texting and all that. So I think that's one reason why relationships dry up, because we lack those verbal skills. Now, this story is set well before there were cell phones and things like that. It's in the 1960s, and it's this story in the South, and these brothers are at the core of it, and the relationship that brothers can have as friends, not just role models, but sort of like people that provide counsel. And there's BMX, like a big racing thing, and the Beatles, this trip to a gig plays a role in this, and there are airborne snakes. So there's a lot of action, but the principal drama of anything great, I think, for all of the action, all of the explosions or snakes falling out of the sky, that type of thing, which we have here, nothing moves us like the action of the relational. That's really what we care the most about. And I think I probably gave you the example one time, like if you're at the subway, you're like it's over by North Station, and there are two people sitting next to you, and they're like, one leans in to say something to the other. You're not being nosy, but you're sort of like listening in on that, because it's just that idea of the relational. And the stakes are probably small there, like you want to get a coffee, that sort of thing. And in this story, Deuce Cross, the stakes are, they're not small, because they're going to have a large role in futures.
And there's also a band. Fender is in a band with lead singer who goes by the nickname of Tusk, and the bassist, Charlie Stickle. And everybody, as you say, everybody knows a Stickle somewhere in their life. And then a young woman that Fender wants to be more than friends with, I would say, in Stace.
Yeah, I would say that I have these characters like that Stickle character, where it's not like a stock character, because they're different, but and they're highly specific, and yet we can sort of read them as these archetypes for people we've known. And you just sort of like, it's almost like that's why Eddie Haskell works so well on Leave It to Beaver, right? Because there's so many people who didn't see the show, who didn't grow up with the show and didn't see the reruns, and you just say, like, he's an Eddie Haskell type. And people knew it, but if, like, you actually watch the show, Leave It to Beaver, you see that character has his own specific mannerisms and expressions, and he's certainly not stock by any means. So what you always want to be doing is moving in between the worlds of the personal and the universal. You want something to feel so tight and specific, and, like, to have this incredible spin rate that it could only apply to you. And you see yourself in that character within the context of your own life. But you want all these other people to have that same experience, too, in their way, while you're also being perfectly clear about the character. So I think that's something that is very challenging to do. I mean, it sounds like, oh, just put some of those in there, it's just going to be a natural way. But sometimes, like, the simplest things aren't really that simple. Their artistry is that they're rendered in a way that we can think they're simple. So I think he's a good example of that. And then you have these dueling alliances, I would say, in this story. And I think something that's interesting about it, too, is when I read these other stories that people write, they could never just go from subject to subject. But when we talk to people, when we have relationships in life, there's all of these other subjects that come in. Now, they're not the most interesting subjects oftentimes, because we're not educated on that many things. But think about, like, just how much you'd have to know about bands to have this whole battle of the bands thing and the terminology work and all that. How much you'd have to know about Beatles, how much you'd have to know about bike racing, and all of these different things that just come up naturally. And when I read something by anyone else right now, it's just that one note. We start with somebody in college, and the story is called Office Hours, and you know exactly where it's going, because that person, besides not really having the gift of being able to imbue language with life and narrative with life, they've just known their very limited experiences. And so that's just not going to work for anything that might last.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to the next story. Red Sweatpants, which includes a narrator who has been dating a lot of yoginis. Right there. There tells us something about him.
There are a lot of, I know, as a former yogini yourself.
Oh, yes.
Very flexible man. What did you call yourself one night? You said, I used to be known as the master of the sit and reach. I'm like, huh. Well, it sounds like vulgar, but I know it's not, but still it sounds, it's summoning some images, right? So, yes, yoginis are, yoga's big. And so this is a kind of, I love this, it's because it's a ghost story, but everyone's alive. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's a ghost story.
Someone is so haunted, they're going across, they're going like out on a date. And if you go out on dates, I mean, I haven't been out on dates since like 2015, but if you go out on a date, it's a good chance you're going out with a yoga person. If not a yogini, it's going to be a yoga woman because they love it. And he has this trauma from his past with the most significant person who had been in his life and had hurt him in this very betrayal-centric kind of way. And like with a lot of trauma, he is trying to process it, but it sort of sinks into the brain. It sinks into the brain in the sense that it sinks through us from like the top on down to like the bottom of your feet. And it also sort of like sinks where you become this almost walking panic attack. And he's going out one night for one of these meetups, and he's crossing like the bridge over like the foggy kind of river. And he thinks he sees this person from his past, but he's so traumatized and disoriented. He's talking on the phone, his cell phone, to his friend, that he's not even sure that it's her. And that causes kind of like a trauma on top of the trauma that he doesn't even know. That he's lost the ability to know this. This would have been like someone like the main person, like more than a parent or like a child. This is like the spouse type of deal. And so he does a 180 on the bridge, and he sort of starts trailing this person who may or may not be this woman from his past. It's not his past of like 30 years ago. It's not 70 or something like that. It's like whatever it is. We can ballpark it 3, 5, 6, 2 years, whatever. It doesn't even really matter. And so he's like heading, they're both heading in the direction of like Beacon Hill in Boston. If you know that neighborhood, it's like a worn of streets. When it's foggy out, it looks a lot like it would have in the 1800s. So you wouldn't be surprised. Well, I mean, they'd have to emigrate. But you wouldn't be surprised to see, like, Jack the Ripper come flying by, chased by Sherlock Holmes. It has that kind of scary vibe to it. It really does, especially if people aren't out and it's, like, drizzling. So he's also following this woman who could be her and recognizes him, or he could just sort of be stalking some terrified woman that he's inflicting trauma upon. But he needs to know. And he's talking to his friend. And he's trying to, like, say things out loud in a certain way that people can, speaking of overhearing, she can hear him. And he's, like, pursuing. He's in flight of closure, in a way. And they end up in, like, that warren of streets in Beacon Hill. And she, like, wields her cell phone almost like it's a weapon. And it could be, it might not be, it could be all these other things. And he hears, like, this siren. And you can't, like, really see her. It's kind of foggy. So it's like, that's what I like, a ghost story, because it's a ghost story, but again, nobody's dead.
And the neighborhood, and especially those Asher Benjamin buildings, in many ways become a character themselves.
Yeah, they do, and that's just, that's the advantage of a place like Boston, narratively, that you have that specific neighborhood, I would say, that has that flavor to it. And so again, the idea of other things coming, all the things you have to know to write something, you're working with an infinite amount of variables. You can use anything. Yeah, the combinations, just the words, the subjects that you can fly in. So in this story, there's a real like architectural like presence where we feel like these looming buildings, and it goes through that particular architect who designed them from way back in the day. And that plays along that thematic idea of the past is here. And so the story, it has to be set where it's set, but it becomes this ghost story. It becomes this mystery. It becomes this outside locked room mystery. It becomes this unburdening of trauma, a deepening of trauma. It ends with like a flight into the night. I mean, it could end with this guy's arrest, like a few blocks later, because it's like if she is calling the cops, then it's not like they apprehend you in the scene. Like they track you down, like they'll catch up with you. But it could also be, and I love this too, it could all be absolutely nothing. Yeah. She might not even notice him. It might not be her. Mm-hmm. And it could just be, I mean, right? It's just the narrative of life. I mean, that's how life is. I feel like that's how the best story functions.
The next story is The Effect of Gravity Upon the Tub. This is such a cinematic story. I want to see the film version of this. I love these characters and what they're up to, what we think they're doing, and the dialogue, it just crackles.
These guys, they're reoccurring characters. I mean, you would know the story, Padraig and Lorcan, is itself in Between Cloud and Horizon. Padraig shows up as almost like this kind of haunted dream, one-man Greek chorus throughout Dark March, and they're in all these other stories by themselves. There are these two Irish criminals, and they are at what appears to be a sort of safe house and in the American Northeast, because their business is not like it's just relegated to Cork and Dublin. They're here for a lot of it, and they're hiding out, and it's like kind of a nice place. You get the feeling it's a nicer place than they normally stay. And Padraig talks in this highly voluble style. He's like this wannabe poet. He's of all of my characters, he's probably the one that I personally would most want to hang out with, but I'd also be fairly terrified of him in some ways, because I think he's capable of a lot. Not just like, yeah, he's willing to go there, but he has his own moral code, the way that like a highly actually moral person would, in that he thinks he's justified, and he's incredibly intelligent. I mean, to write a character like that, he's no boob. So someone shows up who isn't, or might be, who they're expecting, and they're sort of trying to vet this person, and they're hoping that it's not like a recon agent to sort of find them out. And the story hinges in some ways on this clawfoot tub upstairs, where this grisly scene is going to play out that is going to lead to this exodus into the night, because they might have been found out. The person who showed up is no longer there, but they have left something hideous, like, behind, that they're not expecting to tow. And so they're lighting out. They're leaving the safe house. But, yeah, it's a crackler. And I always think that, like, think right relationally, right emotionally, right from the inside out. But in my mind, I'm always thinking right cinematically. I remember one time recently we were talking, and I said to you that thing about you have these stories that other people write, and it's like a kit. And here's the character, and they have to be assembled and everything. But like in a really good film, think about like Touch of Evil in that opening tracking shot. It's all immediately, boom, it's just here. There's no ramping up. And I don't mean like starting in the middle of something. I mean, we instantly just know everybody because the camera's on them in a certain way. And so I think that's what you want to do in writing. And yeah, I love these two guys.
Well, and I mentioned cinematic because Yeah, it's like watching a good movie or a good play that doesn't need exposition. You're there, you're in the moment, and instantly you know what's happening and who they are.
Yeah, and the thing about that is, you know that almost everyone does that thing, whether it's like on a Netflix series or it's in anything you read, where they put the exposition in the character's mouth. You know what I'm talking about, right? Someone walks into the room and it's like, how lazy are you, writer? Or how unskilled you are. It's like, so, the last time we were here in May of 2012, it's like, you're just going to start saying it? Just going to walk through it? For all of his volubility, Padraig's, he's not giving you exposition. The exposition is happening naturally. And that's the type of thing, if I read that by someone else, and I was someone else, I would be very upset. It would take away my impetus and my drive, because I think, like, what am I going to do against this? So, like, how is this guy doing this? Like, this, if I could read the way that I'm able to read now and see, like, it's like Van Gogh goes into the museum and he sees things in the paintings that my mom, no offense, Mom, if you're listening, doesn't see. And he would, like, lick his thumb, and he would, like, smudge the corners, and he'd fix things, which you really can't do anymore. But that person threw cake at the Mona Lisa the other day. So, yeah. And these guys, you get the feeling, too, that they're tight, but also they kind of maybe knife each other in the throat.
Oh, yeah.
But they're bosom buddies. And their loyalty and their contrasting style and their complexity and, I just love the title, too, The Effect of Gravity Upon the Tub. I mean, I have to know what that's about.
All right. Now, let me give you, this is an opening line you won't find in stories by anybody else. It's not really killing yourself in the strict killing yourself fashion if you only commit to the thought of killing yourself.
This is a bit of trivia with this one. So this is Junction Regale, and it's set in a train station in England, and some of the main characters, again, it's sort of like a ghost story.
And a very Dickensian feel to it.
Yeah, Dickensian with like a Yabo edge, like a sort of streak of, let's call it Christian vulgarity, rather than just like vulgarity for vulgarity's sense. And some of the buddies of this narrator, I mean, it's such a voice-driven story, because I've never seen a voice like that in its first person. But it's plot still. It's this contrast of what we want someone to live up to, and maybe that person that we want to live up to that standard is the person that isn't around anymore, and we're sort of making do with someone who's coming closer to that mark in our present tense. But the feeling's not quite the same. And it's a quasi-suicidal narrator, I would say, who is dealing with some horrible things that's going on with his mother. And some of his best friends, in his mind, are late Requiem composers. So he's talking about, like, Mozart. And he's addressing him as the monster and Gabriel Fauré. And he's like, he's like debating in his head. He's pitting them against each other for who has the best Requiem. And it's written in England, in like a Northern English. So you have Patrick, it's a very international book in some ways, because you have like Patrick and Lorcan, they're obviously Irish. And Patrick sounds is Irish as you can be without doing like that cheap kind of like Roddy Doyle theatrical rubbish that I don't like. But this is a very English story. And you wouldn't think that an American would be able to write this story, and it's very dreamlike, and it reads as, did I tell you about the time I was working in a hardware store, and I would read in between the customers, and one day I was reading Rimbaud, and this woman came in, and she was French, and a lot of the people came to the hardware store would talk to me like I was a complete idiot, like I was just like some buffoon, and I was just only good at hardware, like joke was on them, because I was absolutely terrible at hardware, like I couldn't even cut a key, but she took the Rimbaud from me. She said, do you want me to read it to you in the French? Because it was like a dual translation. And she did. Now, I didn't know what it meant, like, as the actual words in French. But I knew what the poem meant. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I could still tell because of the sound. And I think Junction Regale works that way. What I think will probably blow your mind, this is a bit of trivia, is it was one of the very first things I ever had published. So it's something from, like, 25 years ago.
I love this line. I am a back alley traipser and an off-season mongerer.
Yeah, and you know what it's like? That line, I remember it's like back in my head back then, because it's like I have these other like ideas, these other lines that have nothing to do with what ends up in the story. So this is going back to like the early 2000s. I can tell you like where that came from. The idea of like someone who would watch, and it's not what it is in the story at all. It's nothing to do with the story. And like it sounds completely incongruous, but I would think about people who would watch Christmas specials like at all times of the year. The notion that you'd be this off-season monger, and how someone can be like an off-season monger in other capacities and facets of their life. But you see what I mean? So it's like that's something that I would think, and I would like watch a Christmas special. Like, and I mean, if it comes on even now, I'm going to watch it no matter what it is. I like when I like Christmas is over and I first like see that rerun of the sitcom. It's just on a loop. They're not even like trying to think it through. They just go in the order they go in. And I'm like, oh, yeah. But that idea of being, like, an off-season monger, because, again, it's playing on that theme of, like, against the grain, going against the current, against, like, a kind of natural order. Because I think we're always trying to find some sort of semblance of the natural order in situations, the relational and the emotional, that are unnatural. Because that's the nature of nature of emotion. Emotion isn't like nature, where it's like, okay, this is the way that the eagle's going to build the nest, and they're all going to do it this way. There isn't going to be some eagle that has, like, some modernist design. You're like, wow, look at that up there, and he's, like, rocking out to Frank Zappa. No, he's going to be the eagle. He always does it the same way. So I think in other ways, in our own lives, we're all sort of like off-season mongers. Or we are when we're fully alive. And so that he has that moment of cognizance, it imbues the story with some hope. I mean, that's part of the subtitle of this book. It's the last word. Gimbal, the last word is always very important. The last story, the last line, the last word of a book, they're freighted with a special meaning. So, yeah, that's what's going on there.
The book is If You Brackets, Fabulous Fantasy, Effery, and that word hope, Colin Fleming. The book available everywhere fine books are sold. Colin, thank you as always, my friend. Get down, take care of yourself, more vapor rub, and we need you to score 42 points again next week for us.
Okay, I appreciate it, buddy.
All right, see you, Colin. Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.